Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. There are few actors from the 20th century who continue to be thought about, talked about, and argued about in the 21st century. One is Marlon Brando. My guest today is Bert Kearns, author of Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel. It's published by Applause Theater and Cinema Books, and available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. For everything about Bert, go to bertkearns.com, or you can go to marlonbrandobook.com. And Bert, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be back.
Yeah, you're right in your preface. I'm going to quote here. There have been many biographies written about Marlon Brando. His life has been examined. His work has been deconstructed. His affairs have been chronicled. His embarrassments and tragedies have been rehashed, often with glee. And you continue, this is also quoting, not a biography. What follows is not another Marlon Brando biography nor hagiography, but a study of how one man's artistic and personal decisions affected not only those around him, but all of Western society and popular culture, end quote. That's a pretty tall order to write about. What drew you to the subject?
That was the question, was what can you write that's new about Marlon Brando? Here we were approaching his centenary, his 100th birthday, 20 years after his death. What new could I write? So I went back to when I was a kid in the 1960s and the poster I had on my wall. I had the poster from The Wild One. I think a lot of us did. I also had the poster of Peter Fonda from Easy Rider on his motorcycle with a red, white, and blue gas tank. That was big back then. And I went back to that image because that was the image I knew of Marlon Brando when I was a kid. He was in the zeitgeist, but I wasn't a Marlon Brando movie fan then. I was about 16 when The Godfather came out. That's when I got to really see Marlon Brando. So it was a matter of how is Marlon Brando influencing popular culture today. I'm not a cinephile. I love movies, but I'm not a film expert. I'm a pop culture journalist. So I started digging and going down the rabbit holes and seeing where it would lead. So I wound up using Brando's biography as a jumping off point to the different parts of popular culture that he influenced along the way and continued to influence today. And most of it went back to the movie The Wild One.
So you never had the poster of On the Waterfront?
No, that was that they didn't sell that at Woolworth's for 99 cents.
So you started from that basis. And tell us a little bit, because you're very thorough in your research and in your writing. How did you then go from that initial observation? And again, from your perspective as a popular culture journalist, you then, and some of the titles, I'll give some of the titles out, Cyclist, Raid, Meet 21, Welcome to Hollywood, Elvis, Teenage Raceland, et cetera. We'll get into some of that as well. But how did you decide to structure that book? And again, with the knowledge that there have been plenty of books on Marlon Brando.
Well, The Wild One was Marlon Brando's fifth film. It wasn't his greatest film. He came to Hollywood as the brat from Broadway, the mumbling star who changed the face of theater with his animal grace, with his sexuality, and with his naturalism that he brought to the stage in A Streetcar Named Desire, came to Hollywood and revolutionized film the same way. His first movie was The Men. It was a movie that was produced by Stanley Kramer, who was a liberal message producer. He was the one who made movies that wanted to have social impact. And in this first film, Brando played a paraplegic war veteran trying to adjust to the fact that he possibly can't satisfy his fiance and will never walk again. Brando came to Hollywood. He didn't check into the Beverly Hills Hotel, get an estate in Coldwater Canyon. He bunked on his aunt's couch in the suburbs and then checked into a VA hospital where he lived for a month as a paraplegic. And the other patients at the hospital thought that he really was one. When he did interviews with the press, he'd wheel himself out in the wheelchair and explain what it was like to live like that. Actors didn't do that back then. Brando did. Over his next three films, he did A Streetcar Named Desire, Viva Zapata, and the mumbler did Shakespeare. He played Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. 3 Academy Award nominations for Best Actor. His next film is a biker flick. Now, back then, there was no such thing as a biker flick. There was no such thing as a youth market or a teenage movie market. He thought he was doing another movie that had great social relevance. In 1947, there was a very publicized riot in a town in Northern California called Hollister, where they had invited motorcyclists, all the motorcycle clubs, into town for a weekend of fun. Well, they didn't realize that after World War II, there was a new breed of motorcyclists. These weren't proper gentlemen who rode in nice outfits and obeyed traffic laws. These were veterans who came back from World War II. They had seen horrific things that they couldn't talk about, and they couldn't adjust back to society. So they took these Harley Davidsons that they had back in Europe when they were in the war, and they got the American versions, and they got together in groups, and they took to the road. And they all showed up in Hollister over 4th of July weekend in 1947 and just wrecked the place. And Life magazine exploited it, and it became known as this terrible biker riot. Well, a man named Frank Rooney wrote a fictional piece based on that called Cyclist's Raid. That became the basis for The Wild One. Marlon Brando and the producers thought they were going to show the effects of World War II, the plight of the veteran, and also juvenile delinquency, which was also on the rise and a big concern among, you know, Congress and social groups, et cetera. So they set out to make this film that meant something. Well, of course, it immediately runs up against the censors. They take out everything Marlon Brando thought was important and just left in the anarchy. It's about a motorcycle gang that comes into a town. They do lots of mischief. Then another motorcycle gang comes into town. All hell breaks loose. Brando's accused of a murder. Blah, blah, blah. Everything goes crazy. Brando walked away from it and said, "What a disappointment. I thought I was going to do something good. This, I just forget about it." He moves on and he makes On the Waterfront. But meanwhile, this picture comes out right at the dawn of 1954, and the kids see it, and they identify with Brando in his black leather jacket and his motorcycle gang. And right about that time, the Supreme Court comes out with its Brown versus Board of Education ruling, where they say that segregation in schools is unconstitutional. So you've got this civil rights movement starting. This youth revolution is starting. And before you know it, The Wild One becomes a major influence on both that. It actually launches the rock and roll generation, even though there wasn't a note of rock and roll in the film. Brando was a jazz man. This was a jazz. Well, the score was just, you know, jazz, Stan Kenton type jazz. And so you start there. Then you find out that the film was banned. It was banned in Memphis, Tennessee, the summer that Elvis Presley got out of high school. And you find out that Elvis Presley could see the movie across the river. It was banned in Memphis, but you could watch it in West Memphis in Arkansas. And that he told friends, and later he told reporters, he thought that being a music star was great. It was great that he got a record deal, et cetera, but he really wanted to be an actor. And when he got a contract at Paramount Pictures, he told everybody, "I'm going to be like Marlon Brando. That's how you make it big. I'm going to go to the Actors Studio, and guess what? None of my films are going to have any music in it. I'm just going to act." And so it went on from there. I'm like, ah. And so as I followed Brando's life, I used it as a jumping off point toward different things. And it all leads to this. There would not be a leather man in The Village People, not for The Wild One.
Do you think that Marlon Brando had a sense of his impact on the culture, either through The Wild One or through subsequent films? And I'm thinking even of The Godfather.
Brando always denied it. That was the thing with Brando. Acting meant very little to him. It came so naturally. He would have rather been a social activist. He would rather have been an inventor. And when The Wild One came out and had this incredible impact, came out a year and a half before Blackboard Jungle and Rebel Without a Cause, he said, "No, just I was in the right place at the right time. It would have happened anyway. I had nothing to do with it." And I think, of course, he did have a realization of his impact, but publicly he would always deny it.
How did you come up with the title Hollywood Rebel? He was certainly different from the typical actor or a celebrity in Hollywood at that time and other decades as well. But how did you come up with the title Brando, Hollywood Rebel? Again, it's published by Applause Theater and Cinema Books and available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. What was it that caused you to come up with that title, or did someone suggest it to you?
Well, you see that, first of all, that image. He's Johnny Rebel, the motorcycle gang leader. But he was a rebel in many other ways. He was a rebel from the moment he arrived in Hollywood. When you come to Hollywood, you're expected, especially in the late 1940s, early 1950s, you're expected to sign with a studio. You're expected to genuflect at the altar of the gossip columnists. You're expected to be matched up with the latest starlet and show up at the Elma Combo and get your picture taken on the Sunset Strip and go through all these motions. Brando didn't. They say, this is probably legend, that he arrived with a suitcase that had a couple of dirty t-shirts and a pair of jeans, and that's what he wore. And he had a motorcycle, and he scrambled around up the hills. You know, again, he bunked on his aunt's couch. He broke all the rules. And when he did an interview with, let's say, a Hedda Hopper or a Luella Parsons, he lied to them. Or he wouldn't listen to their questions. And they said, this young man is very disrespectful, but there's something about him. And it was this tremendous talent that they said, you know what? We get it. This guy is different. And Hollywood, I think it was Hedda Hopper who said, you know, we thought Hollywood was going to change him. I got a feeling this guy is going to change Hollywood. And he did. And of course, later in the decade, when the journalists and the gossips had their chance to get back at Brando, when he gave them an opening, they went in for the kill and they humiliated him as best they could.
Was there a connection or comparison between Marlon Brando and James Dean?
There was quite a connection. James Dean was in love with Marlon Brando. James Dean loved him as an actor, loved him as a man, wanted to love him as a lover. So James Dean was basically discovered in motion pictures by Elijah Kazan, the director who directed Brando on stage in A Streetcar Named Desire, directed him in Streetcar on film, and also in his Academy Award-winning role in On the Waterfront. He hired James Dean for a film called East of Eden. And he said, this guy reminds me a lot of Brando. You got to meet this guy. Brando's making another picture. He'd moved on from The Wild One, and he'd actually, I believe, moved on from Waterfront by that point. But you got to meet this kid, James Dean. Well, James Dean meets Marlon Brando, and he is just slavish around him. Brando goes to a party. James Dean is in the next room following him around. James Dean is dressing like him. James Dean buys bongo drums because Brando liked to play bongas and congos. And Brando is just like, he felt sorry for the kid, but he sort of iced him. And at one point he said, look, James, you've got to be yourself. You can't be me. You know, just be yourself. And I also think you should see a psychiatrist or talk to somebody about this issue that you have. Brando thought that James Dean would have a lot of time and eventually become a great actor. He didn't have a lot of time. He was killed, of course. But Brando also realized that James Dean wasn't in love with Marlon Brando. He was in love with Johnny Strabler, his character from The Wild One. And Brando's like, that's not me. I'm not Mark Anthony. I'm not, you know, he went on to Guys and Dolls. He said, I'm an actor. And that wasn't me. And so there have been stories about Brando and James Dean being lovers, et cetera. But Brando always denied it and said, you know, I felt sorry for him. I identified with him for, you know, his traumatic childhood and his loneliness, et cetera. But, you know, the kid needed help.
I'm thinking of the film and originally the stage play, The Odd Couple. And a lot of people don't realize the perfect odd couple, and it should have been in on stage and in film, was Marlon Brando and Wally Cox. Can you explain that relationship? And for those of our listeners and viewers who may not even know who Wally Cox is at this point, who Wally Cox was, and how it is that he and Marlon Brando were fast friends.
Wally Cox is one of those comic actors who was sort of a Woody Allen type. He was first known on television in the 50s for a show called Mr. Peepers. So that puts it right there. He was Mr. Peepers. I think later he showed up on Hollywood Squares. And he was a smart little intellectual type, looked spindly, et cetera.
little mousy.
Pardon me?
Okay. A little mousy.
And he was known as, you know, Marlon Brando's friend. They were this odd couple. Well, it turns out that Marlon Brando and Wally Cox knew each other when they were 9 years old in Evanston, Illinois. They knew each other in school, and they were fast friends in school. I think at the time, Brando, who was never like a real tough guy, but he had some charisma and he was big. He protected Wally Cox at school. Wally Cox's family moved on. Wally Cox joined the Air Force. He may have seemed like a mousy type, but he really wasn't. He was an athletic guy. He had been in the Air Force, et cetera. 10 years after they had last seen each other, Brando is living in New York City. He's getting his start in acting, and he's walking down Sixth Avenue with his sister, who's coming up Sixth Avenue, but there's Wally Cox. Wally! Bud! Marlon was known as Bud Brando when he was a kid. They hit it off again as if they had never lost those 9 or 10 years between them. Fast friends, Brando described him as a brother, more than a brother. They were soulmates. He was his greatest friend. When Wally Cox died, Brando went to his widow and said, "Could I have some his ashes? I want to scatter them on the hills where we used to hike together." And she said, "Yeah, sure." And he took the ashes. He also snatched a pair of Wally Cox's pajamas to have with him. As it turned out, Brando did not scatter those ashes. He kept the urn. He kept them with him. He would take them in the car with him and talk to them in the car. He would sit down and have a cup of coffee and talk to the ashes. And Wally Cox stayed with him over the next 20 years of his life. When Brando died, they took some of those ashes, mixed them in with Marlon's, and scattered them in Death Valley. So their friendship goes on into eternity.
That's a great amazing story. Yeah, it is.
People say they were lovers and sexual mates, but that wasn't the case with them. It was a truly friendship of the ages.
You mentioned in your book, and I also mentioned in the introduction, quoting you in your book, about the number of biographies that are out there over the decades about Marlon Brando. When you decided to write this book, did you research beyond the typical biographies that are there? Were you able to talk to people who may still be around who knew him? How did you organize your research to come up with this version of the book? Again, Brando, Hollywood Rebel.
Well, I had all the major biographies. I had some of the more scandalous biographies. I had some of the showbiz biographies. I had all of his films. I had the documentaries that are out there. I watched every one of his pictures. I watched his talk show appearances, included some of a couple of those in the book because they became historic. His talks with Johnny Carson about civil rights weeks after Martin Luther King was killed, his chats about acting with Dick Cavett, which are still out there. And I also was very lucky in that I've produced and written a lot of documentaries. I produced and wrote one feature film. It was a Burt Reynolds comedy called Cloud Nine. Burt Reynolds played the coach of a beach volleyball team comprised of strippers. We'll skip that part of it. But it was written and produced. My co-writer, along with my production partner at the time, was Brett Hudson. Our partner was Albert S. Ruddy. Al Ruddy, of course, was the producer of The Godfather and won the Academy Award for producing The Godfather. The executive producer of the film and a great source in the book was Gray Frederickson. Gray was the associate producer on The Godfather, won the Academy Award for producing Godfather Part II. He produced Apocalypse Now. He worked with Brando on his early films like Candy. So these guys knew Brando, and I got to hear Brando's stories firsthand. And I spoke to Gray a lot throughout this. And he passed away in the middle of the research. Unfortunately, he was in his 80s. But yes, I was able to speak to people that knew Brando. I have friends who dated some of Brando's daughters. He's got a few daughters out there in Hollywood. And so, yes, I was able to get more of a picture of the man.
What was the most surprising thing that you found out in your research for this book about Marlon Brando? Is there something that you discovered about him that has not been reported before, either in the media or in any of the biographies?
Well, aside from the areas of popular culture that he has influenced. A lot of those were surprising. Everything, you know, you start with, you know, Andy Warhol's art, punk rock music, actors like, you know, we know about Johnny Depp, but the influence that he had on Andrew Dice Clay and, you know, the blossoming of Andrew Dice Clay's talent as an actor beyond the Dice Man is directly related to Marlon Brando, and in this case, Streetcar Named Desire. But I was most surprised in the very beginning by finding out how little acting meant to him, and how much of his acting career he put aside in favor of social activism. From the time he was a kid in military school, I had described him as a rebel in search of a cause. And he found that cause when he came to New York. He went to the New School for Social Research, became a student in its dramatic workshop, and was taken under the wing of a teacher named Stella Adler. And Stella Adler was part of a Jewish acting dynasty. Her father was a famous Yiddish actor, Jacob Adler. Her brother was Luther Adler, the actor and director. And for the first time in Brando's life, he said he met Jews, he met Jewish people, and they were intellectual and they were socially conscious and they taught him. This was during World War II. He saw what was going on, the Holocaust in real time. He saw what was happening. And at the time, he was really starting to strike it big as an actor. He'd been on Broadway. People had noticed him. He had a chance to appear in a play by Eugene O'Neill called The Iceman Cometh. He read it. He fell asleep reading the first act. It was boring. Instead, he took a role in what was a propaganda play. It was called A Flag Is Born. It was produced by a group called the American League for a Free Palestine. And this group was trying to raise money to build a ship to help move the displaced Jews from Europe from World War II to this new homeland in Palestine called Israel. Now, the British had control over the Palestinian region, and they were stopping these ships. They were taking these people who had been in concentration camps, diverting the ships, and putting them in camps in Cyprus. Well, this group, the American League for a Free Palestine, was not only raising money to buy a ship, they were also funneling money to a group called the Irgun, which was Menachem Begin's militant, or as Brando called them, terrorist group, who were trying to convince the British in more forceful ways to let these people in. Brando, after he did that play, put his career aside again to go on the road as a spokesman for this group. And he and another actor were on a bus. They went around the country and they gave speeches at synagogues and in community centers to raise money for this project. While he was on this tour, he went into the Deep South for the first time and saw racism firsthand and segregation and couldn't believe what he was seeing. And he said, you know, in letters to his parents, for the first time, I'm doing something important. And so one of the things that surprised me was that Marlon Brando helped create the State of Israel. And I was like, go Marlon.
I didn't even realize that. Yeah, I didn't realize he had that part of his background. It amazes me as you tell your story about him that he was still productive in terms of putting aside plays, but just motion pictures that he was able to produce, or he was able to act in all these films. And yet at the same time, as you indicated, he's busy with civil rights and other social action. So he must have had an enormous amount of energy. He obviously had the talent, but to be able to do all that within his lifetime.
Well, it's funny. I was doing the research and I looked up Robert De Niro. I think I have it here. Robert De Niro is 80 years old now. He's the age that Brando was when Brando died. On the IMDb website, Robert De Niro has 135 movie credits and counting. Brando at 48. And including some that were made, they use his image or his voice after his death. So he did put his acting career aside for a long period. You know, he never went back to the stage, never went back to Broadway after Streetcar. And then I guess after he did the film Last Tango in Paris, which took a lot out of him because a lot of it was improvised and he put a lot of his real life into it, he never really put his heart into acting. after that. He was mostly in cameo roles where he was paid a lot of money. If you put Marlon Brando in your picture, you can attract, you know, box office talent that want to act with him. But acting again was, to him, it was to finance his causes, to finance, you know, what he wanted to do in life, especially in the 60s. They call the 1960s his lost decade. This was a time when he was involved in the civil rights movement, the Native American movement. He was working with the Black Panthers at the time, environmentalism, anti-death penalty movement, doing all this through this decade. And he made movies here and there. But I watched all these flicks, and he never phoned it in once. And when I make a list of, like, you know, the top five or six Brando films to watch, two or three of them are from the 60s. He did some great work, although that, you know, they didn't make money, so he was called box office poison at that time.
But still, even in relation to other actors, he maybe, it doesn't sound like he's made a lot of films, but if you combine that with his social activism, it's pretty impressive.
Oh, you know, tremendous. Yeah. And at the same time, and the influence that he had as well. You know, when he made when he was hired to do The Godfather in about 1971, Paramount Pictures didn't want him. We don't want Marlon Brando. You know, he's box office poison, they said. And they wanted, you know, Frank Sinatra, Laurence Olivier, maybe Ernest Borgnine. You know, but Ruddy and the producers, you know, push for him. And Brando, you know, the greatest actor of the 20th century, agrees to do a screen test. He was 47 years old, in the best condition of his life. He was buff. He was in good shape, with the cotton in his cheeks, put in a little prosthetic in his mouth, padded himself up. And before their eyes, he became Don Corleone. And they said, well, I guess he's our man. And nobody appreciated it more than the young actors that he worked with. You know, the suits at Paramount might say, we don't want Marlon Brando here. But you've got, you know, Robert Duvall, Al Pacino, John Cazale, Talia Shire. This is, you know, Jimmy Kahn. We're working with Marlon Brando. And we're working with this giant, this legend. And what does Brando do in order to make these guys feel comfortable? He participates in mooning contests with them throughout the production.
Before I let you go, what's your favorite Marlon Brando film?
I think my favorite has to be now Last Tango in Paris. I saw Last Tango when I was 17 years old. Ooh, it's the movie with the sex, etc. Watched it 50 years later and said, oh my God, how could I have even managed to try to understand what this film was about and what Brando put into it. A tremendous performance by Brando in Last Tango in Paris. And quickly, another film that I really enjoy is from the 60s. It was called Bedtime Story. It was co-written by Paul Henning, who created Green Acres. Can't go wrong there. And he played a con man who preyed on women in Europe, gets together with David Niven, who's a debonair con man on the French Riviera, and they con these women out of money, jewelry, and love. It was remade in the 1980s as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with Steve Martin. Brando is in the Steve Martin part, and he does a Jerry Lewis-level comic performance that got great reviews at the time, and it's a surprising movie to watch and to see how similar Steve Martin's performance was to Brando's.
Hmm.
There you go. There are so many treasures among his work that it's really hard to pick out one or two.
Well, you did too, at least, so that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Bert Kearns. He's author of Marlon Brando, Hollywood Rebel. It's published by Applause Theater and Cinema Books. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Bert, that's B-U-R-T, go to BertKearns.com, BertKearns.com, or MarlonBrandoBook.com, MarlonBrandoBook.com. And Bert, thanks for being on the show.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You got it. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.